to quote it as, it's a blood libel to even make the comparison. That's the first thing. The second thing is, as Norman Finkelstein has pointed out so beautifully, much of the intention of the Holocaust academia has got nothing to do with trying to change the world's relationship to cruelty and unfairness. It's to establish a sense of Jewish exceptionalism so that we're the perpetual victims and that everything we do is justified, everything that's done to us is an outrage. A case example is Germany, where Germany is often lauded as the country which has taken responsibility for its actions. Unlike, say, Japan, which has failed to acknowledge that it prostituted Korean women in the service of the Japanese forces in Korea and China. Well, that's true. Germany has pleaded mea culpa. But what have they learned? Nothing. It's in Germany that it's least dangerous for a Jew to speak about Palestine. Jews are arrested in Germany for calling for justice for the Palestinians. So teaching about the Holocaust teaches nobody anything. And the point is twofold. One is, you cannot teach morality. Morality is a natural human attribute that arises when people's human needs as children are met. Number one. Number two, you can preach about morality in the service of the most nefarious causes. And that's what we're seeing right now. I'm sure you've heard this statement before. The Hebrew word for the Holocaust is Shoah. And there's an old saying, there's no business like Shoah business. It's been exploited to the hilt. And, you know, I'm somebody whose grandparents died in Auschwitz, who nearly ended up there myself. And I'm sick of it. I'm sick of hearing about it. Not because didn't happen, but because what it has been pressed into the service of. Now, I'd like to ask you a question. You mentioned the Warsaw Ghetto, and one of the leaders of the Warsaw Ghetto, Marek Edelman, who survived the war and became a cardiac surgeon or cardiologist and a real fighter for liberty, supported the Solidarity labor movement, always stood for Palestinian rights. Needless to say, when he died, nobody in Israel mentioned a word about it, or very little. But during the Warsaw Ghetto, after that desperate resistance was crushed, the Germans went to the ghetto, burning down all the homes, all the houses, and Jews would jump out of the windows to their death to escape the fires. And the Germans called them parachutists. Utter contempt for these human beings as they went to their death. Now, I've seen the same thing in Israel now. Not just the cruelty, everything you described, but the contempt. Have you seen that anywhere else? You've covered Sarajevo and the Bosnian horrors. You've covered Salvador and the death squads. You've covered the Middle East. What do you make of this incredible contempt? Have you thought about it?
You have to linguistically render people non-human before you kill them.
Yeah.
So this is why the current rhetoric around the Trump administration is so dangerous. It took 4 years of hate-filled speech before you got any Serbs to cross into Bosnia to begin the genocide. And I think when you read the early history of the Nazis' rise to power, from 1933 to 1938, at least, Claudia Kunz writes about this, Hitler had to back off from going after the Jews, rhetorically. You had Kristallnacht, you had the brown shirts and the Nuremberg laws. That's why language is so key. Once you linguistically render people to quote Galantz, to be human animals. And once people believe it, then it becomes, and we read about that in the death camps, Lipton's great book on Nazi doctors. They didn't look at them as human. And that was true in every war that I covered. And I would say the other thing is that you build this bizarre kind of a worldview where evil is embodied in another.
Yeah.
And that when you eradicate the other, you've eradicated evil. That, of course, what it does is actually expand our own propensity for evil. And I think it's interesting, you know, as you know, I graduated from divinity school, but I think in all of the great religious texts, there's an, including the Quran, when the prophet writes about jihad, he writes about three types of jihad, but the most important jihad is the battle to curb the evil within us. That's why I think Primo Levi is such an important writer.
Yeah.
Because, and Levi argued over and over that that they were bastardizing or missing the true lesson of the Holocaust, in that we can all become Rumkowski, the Jewish collaborator who led the Lodz Ghetto.
Yeah.
But yes, language. Language is key. And you know, watching the way Trump and his minions use language to describe immigrants, to describe, you know, the radical leftists, we're moving very swiftly, and it's not a long step from the linguistic dehumanization to violence.
It's interesting you mentioned Trump, because a couple of days ago in Washington, D.C., I was there for an interview with Al Jazeera, and the person being interviewed right after me was Mary Trump, who's Donald Trump's niece. She's documented the incredible trauma in that family. But she writes something very interesting, which I think is very relevant to what you just said. In her book, The Reckoning, Mary Trump writes, and you gotta get, she comes from the same family. Same family. And she writes, we are a nation shackled by a cultural imperative to move from the pain of war, mass death, disease, and government-sanctioned barbarity in the name of peace or healing or a return to normal, when all we've really been doing is preserving the unchecked impunity of the powerful to inflict pain again, again, and again. This is Mary Trump.
I want to ask you about despair. I spent 7 years in and out of Gaza. And you were right, I think, in your speech to cite that sense of futility that we all feel, despite all of the energy many of us in this room put in to battling this genocide.
Yeah.
I know I find a kind of solace having been raised in a religious household, that it, you know, we're not finally judged by what we empirically achieve, but what we strive to achieve.
Yeah.
But despair is something you know a lot more about than I do, and I'm sure there's many like me in this room who struggle with it daily.
Well, I feel despair all the time. Not all the time, but frequently. So despair is a perfectly normal emotion. So is hatred, by the way. These are perfectly normal emotions in the face of what we're dealing with right now. But let me read you something that might put it into perspective. This is somebody writing a long time ago, but he might as well be writing about Gaza. He says, greed, hatred, and delusion of every kind are unwholesome. Whatever action a greedy, hating, and deluded person heaps up by deeds, words, or thoughts, that is unwholesome. Whatever such a person, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, and his thoughts controlled by them, inflicts under false pretexts upon another by killing, imprisonment, confiscation of property, false accusations, or expulsion, that is all unwholesome. Who do you think is writing here? It's the Buddha.
Oh, wow.
2,500 years ago. And he's talking about expulsion, torture, confiscation of property, false accusation, killing, imprisonment. The Buddha, 2,500 years ago. Why am I saying this? Not to minimize in any way or to dismiss the importance of the present moment, but human beings have been dealing with this for a long time. And what is actually amazing and what is to be celebrated, this is my antidote to despair, such as it is. What is to be celebrated is that in the face of thousands of years of that kind of history, people still love the truth. People still love liberation. People still love freedom. People are still committed to justice. People are still outraged when they see these patterns arise and arise and over again. So that in addition to the despair, there's that real humanity that has never been extirpated and never will be. For what it's worth, that's my antidote to despair. That this is a long-term story, and we can all make a contribution. And I think the response to despair, for God's sakes, do something, however little, however limited, but do it. Because it's the absence of agency, lack of activity, lack of engagement that really engenders despair.
Yeah. Well, you know, all of these protests and these wonderful, courageous students who are our nation's conscience, who set up these encampments, to be honest, I would appear at the edge of the Columbia or Princeton. It was my therapy.
Yeah.
Really, quite literally. You know, I owe those students so much, and I admire them so much, and some of them are with us tonight.
Gideon Levy mentioned this recently, but I was aware of this for quite a while. A couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I went on a podcast with a Hollywood actor and comedian whose name is Mayim Bialik. And Mayim Bialik is one of the most fervent and ignorant and contemptuous supporters of Zionism you'll ever find. But that never came up in our interview, and I didn't know it about her at the time. Otherwise, frankly, I would not have gone on her program. We just talked about the stuff I usually talk about. Now, Mayim Bialik had a great, great, great grand uncle or grandfather called Chaim Nachman Bialik, who wrote a poem called The City of Slaughter. And The City of Slaughter was a poem that described these pogroms, these anti-Jewish massacres in the city of Kishinev in Russia, or in, I think in what's Ukraine now, in 1905. I'm going to read you the first two stanzas of Mayim Bialik, who's a great supporter of genocide. I'm going to read this poem by her distant antecedent in the Bialik family. It's called The City of Slaughter. And Gideon Levy recently printed this about Gaza. And here's the poem, the beginning of it. Rise and go now to the city of slaughter. Into its courtyard wind your way. There with thine own hands, touch with the eyes of thine hand and with the eyes of thy head. Behold on tree, on stone, on fence, on mural clay, the spattered blood and dyed brains of the dead. Proceed to the ruins, the split walls, reach where wider grows the hollow and greater grows the breach. Pass over the shattered earth and attain the broken wall, whose burnt and barren brick, whose charred stones reveal the open mouth of wounds that no mending shall ever mend and nor healing ever heal. Now, this is Bialik writing about Kishinev. My God, he's writing about Gaza. And his great-great-granddaughter, whoever she is, cheers it on. That's the world that we're living in.
Let's first of all hear it for Chris and Dr. Matei. We would like to take some questions now from the audience. So if you have any questions, please feel free to line up.
I became a father in November, just after October 2023. Mm-hmm. Since then, I have seen dead children, starving children, mutilated families. Every day while I feed and dress my son, and I feel a lot of hatred. But I also, maybe because of some despair, I feel maybe delusional hope. I hope for the rise of the global south. I almost feel like it can't be any worse than what we're experiencing now. It can only be better. Do you feel that the world from a non-Western led order would be better?
Yes. The global south endured its own holocausts, which are not acknowledged by the perpetrators. The Herero, the Namaqua, the Armenians, the 1943 Bengal famine, in which 3 million Hindus died, and of course, Native Americans and African Americans have suffered holocausts. And Ami Cesari, in his book Discourse on Colonialism, said the reason the Holocaust resonated in the West is because it was done against white people. I do think that we are seeing the rise of the global South assert itself. At the same time, if you haven't figured it out yet, all Trump and all his grifters and yahoos and Christian fascists are doing a pretty good job of imploding the American empire. They're going to take a lot of people down with them, but that's what they're doing. So yes, we are entering a world where the kind of hegemony of both Europe and the United States is no longer enforceable, and I don't know how, after this genocide, any figure from the UK, from Germany, from the United States is going to be able to stand up and talk about American virtue or the rule of law. I think we've been exposed for who we are.
Hi. I just returned from Gaza 2 weeks ago as a humanitarian worker, and just yesterday, the United Nations humanitarian country team put out the statement of rejecting the plan for Israeli military-administered aid. So my question is, what does morality and solidarity look like for these humanitarian organizations or institutions? And what then should regular people like us do who still want to help humans living in Gaza?
You know, I really wonder about that myself, because like even an organization like Middle East Children's Alliance, for whom this benefit is being held tonight, if the Israelis really decide that they're going to be the spigot that's either open or closed for humanitarian aid, food, medicine, to get into Gaza, how's anybody going to force it through when the rest of the world allows them to maintain that control? So I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that. When we donate money, I mean, I'm not trying just to discourage anybody, on the contrary, but in this world that we're heading into, how we can even ensure that the pittance that we can put together would even get through? Do you have any answer to that, Chris?
Clearly, they want to use aid as a weapon. precisely what the Israelis are attempting to do. The militarization of aid is not an Israeli invention, by the way. USAID, let's not sugarcoat what that was very much weaponized in the interests of large corporations and the American empire. But this is just a disastrous move because it will just become another weapon in Israel's arsenal to manipulate and, I fear, push the Palestinians probably into the northern Sinai.
I think we can just keep pushing and talking and advocating and donating and have some trust that they can't do everything that they want to do. We have to be wise to their tricks. Hmm. Now, for years, this is before October the 7th, whenever the New York Times mentioned Hamas, it would de rigueur add, Hamas is an organization that denies the right of Israel to exist. Now, first of all, that wasn't even quite true. But even insofar as it was, when they mentioned the Likud, in whose constitution it's forbidden to think about a non-Jewish state between the river and the sea, they would never say Likud is an organization who denies the right of the Palestinian state to exist. But we just take it for granted. Even now, when they report the number of Palestinian dead, they say, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Ministry of Health, they never say, according to the Trump-run American Ministry of Health or the Likud-run Israeli Ministry of Health. These little tricks that get under our skin without even us noticing it. That's the first point. Second point is, I read the biography or the memoirs of Albert Speer. Speer was an interesting character. He was the Hitler's architect and friend, and also his economic minister. And he spent 20 years in Spandau jail as a war criminal after the Nuremberg trials. And Speer, whether genuinely or disingenuously, but he writes the following. He said, everybody's asking, what did you know? What did you know? But he said, that's the wrong question. He said, the right question is not what did you know, but what you could have known if you wanted to. And he describes two incidents when once he was in one of these factories of Krupp or Tyson, one of these German mega corporations who still exist, where they use slave laborers. And he ran into some of these slave laborers and he asked them, would you rather be here or in the camps? And they looked at them with absolute horror. And Speer said, I never asked them why. And he describes another incident where some German Wehrmacht general is talking to Speer, and Speer says, I'd like to go see what's happening in the East sometime. And the general said, whatever you do, don't go to the East. And Speer said, I never asked why. Now the difference is, that there was no alternative media. There was no YouTube, TikTok, there was no Chris Hedges, there was no Glenn Greenwald, there was no Matt Taibbi, there was no Aaron Mate, there was no Amy Goodman. There was just the mainstream media. Now there are, at least for now, all these alternative sources. People have a lot less excuse not to know now than they ever did in Nazi Germany. And sometimes I do say to people, there's no pain-free option.
Right.
It's a question of which pain would you rather have? The pain of self-suppression, self-betrayal, or the pain of disapproval or sanctions against you? That's your choice, but there's no pain-free option necessarily.
Please join me in thanking our two speakers.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Gabor Mate and Chris Hedges on Palestine, the moral issue of our time. They spoke at the Society of Ethical Culture in New York in May 2025. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent journalist. He's the author of many books. His latest is A Genocide Foretold. Gábor Máté, a Holocaust survivor, is a Hungarian-born Canadian physician with a special interest in childhood development and trauma. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Gábor Máté and Chris Hedges on Palestine, the Moral Issue of Our Time, and for Chris Hedges' book, A Genocide Foretold, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the near future, many homes could act like giant batteries to store energy and help reduce strain on the electric grid. Wesley Whited of the consulting firm DNV Energy Services says historically, utilities have generated electricity and sold it to homes and businesses. But with new technology, they can now buy and sell energy back and forth from consumers.
A virtual power plant is this idea of you as a consumer taking normal household appliances and modulating how they are using their energy based upon signals that are sent from the grid.
So when demand for electricity is high, utilities could automatically turn down people's hot water heaters or thermostats very slightly, and they could draw excess power that's generated by residents' rooftop solar panels or stored in their home battery systems. Whited says consumers would be unlikely to notice the small changes, but the combined impact from many homes would reduce pressure on the grid.
And that is going to defer the utility's need to go build a new substation, to procure a new transmission line, or to build a new natural gas peaking power plant.
So the approach could help utilities meet the growing demand for electricity more efficiently. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.